Thanks, Marion. Well, in August, lots of people are away on different Sundays, so we try and do some fairly self-contained talks. And this year, on the four Sundays, we're going to look at the four Gospels, and I'm just going to get my glasses because I won't be able to read the Bible without them. Do come and sit down in the pews. Maggie, do come and sit down. And I would encourage you to grab a Bible, as you've already, I hope, done, and because I'm going to make you do some work looking at Mark's Gospel, which we're looking at today. In this series, we're going to ask questions like, where do the Gospels come from? Who wrote them? Why were they written? And what unique contribution does each of them make in telling us about Jesus? And I hope, if we have time, that there'll be an opportunity for questions and comments at the end. Now, you might expect me to start with Matthew, the first gospel in the New Testament, but in fact I'm starting with Mark, because many people, probably most experts now, believe that Mark was the first gospel to be written, and that Matthew and Luke based their gospels to some extent on Mark. That is not by any means certain. There are a whole range of different views, I can assure you. But there are some reasons to think that Mark probably came first. When you read the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you notice lots of parallels between them. Things happen in the same order, the same words are used, identical words, and it's undeniable, really, that they must have in some way developed together. Of course, John, the fourth gospel, is very different. And the first three have come to be called synoptic gospels, from a Greek word that means parallel, because they parallel one another so closely. Mark is the shortest, has 11,000 words compared to 18,000 in Matthew and 19,000 in Luke. And that's just 23 pages in our Bible. It takes about an hour and a half to read it out, and that, of course, is how most people would have come across it for many centuries, where there were very few copies. Mark has a simple style, lots of fast-paced action, mainly in the present tense, and the sentences are joined together with the word and, not too many adjectives, and lots of direct speech. He said this, they said that. And until the 19th century, Mark was not given very much attention. It was just seen as a kind of shorter version of Matthew, because there's a very big overlap. Over 90% of Mark is in Matthew, and more than 50% in Luke. But as people looked at it more closely and began to study it in a kind of academic way, they noticed that although Mark is shorter, in the incidents that he looks at, he tends to give us more detail than the others. And I want to look at one example just to give you a sense of that. This is the woman who is healed from her hemorrhages, and it's in all three. And I've set it out kind of parallel, and you'll see there are two pages of this, and the bits in red are the bits that are not in the other accounts. So you'll see there on the first page that Mark is quite a bit longer, and it has quite a bit that's not in the other two. The woman had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors. Luke, the doctor, misses that bit out, funnily enough, and spent all she had, and yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. And then it says she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Then if we go on to the next page, Sam, a bit more there, but again, you'll see there's more that's uniquely in Mark. Matthew is much shorter. And Jesus kept looking around to see who'd done it, the woman knowing what had happened to her. So it really sounds as if someone has talked to her about it, and she told him the whole truth. There's a little bit in Luke that's not in the others, and a tiny bit in Matthew, but Mark is longer and with more unique material, and that's unique. That's typical of the relationship between the Gospels. Now, Mark doesn't have quite a lot. He doesn't have the birth narratives. He doesn't have genealogies. He doesn't have much about the resurrection. And if Matthew is written first, it's very hard to understand why you would write Mark. But if Mark was written first, it's very easy to understand why you would expand it and include those things and produce Matthew. If you look closely at the parallel passages, you'll find that Matthew and Mark often agree against Luke. Luke and Mark often agree against Matthew, but Matthew and Luke very seldom agree against Mark. He seems to be the kind of source from which they are deriving part of the material. Of course, they use other sources as well, but there is quite a lot of evidence that suggests Mark was the first gospel. Now, before we look at where it came from, let's just think about what is a gospel. They're quite unique documents. There's nothing really like them in other ancient writing. And the word gospel is the English version of a Greek word, euangelion, good news. It means good news. And so if you've got your Bible, and if you haven't, please grab one now. You look right at the start of Mark, you'll see it starts off, the first verse is the beginning of the gospel, or the good news about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And it seems quite likely that that verse is where the name gospel came from. And then just look on to verses 14 and 15. After John was put in prison, Jesus went into Galilee proclaiming the good news, or the gospel of God. The time has come, he said, the kingdom of God is near. Repent and believe the good news. So that's where the word gospel comes from. And originally, like all ancient writing, it was written on a scroll. That's why the gospels are all roughly the same length, because that was the maximum amount you could get on one scroll. And it seems likely that when they were put together into a book for the first time, that they were given their titles. The titles were added, so it became the Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Mark, the Gospel according to Luke. The Gospel itself doesn't give any clue, as it were, or doesn't say who wrote it. It's anonymous. But from the beginning, it has been attributed to Mark. There's no record of it ever being attributed to anyone else. And there was a Mark who was very well known in the early church. He's mentioned 5 times in Acts, and 4 times in the epistles, and I just want to look up a couple of those references. So if you flip on to Acts, page 1106, Acts 12, and verse 12 of Acts 12, page 1106, Peter has just been released by an angel from prison, and it says in verse 12, page 1106, when this had dawned on him, on Peter, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying. A prominent woman in the church whose son was called John or Mark. And then look on to the end of that chapter, verse 25, when Barnabas and Saul had finished their mission, they returned from Jerusalem, taking with them John, also called Mark. So he's a close companion of the leaders of the church. Peter, in his letter, later refers to Mark as my son. Now, then there was a quarrel about Mark. Look on to Acts 15, verse 37. Just a few pages on. Acts 15, verse 37. Disagreement between Paul and Barnabas. Down at the bottom of that column on page 1111. Barnabas wanted to take John, also called Mark, with them, but Paul did not think it wise to take him because he deserted them in Pamphylia and had not continued with their work. They had such a sharp disagreement that they parted company. Barnabas took Mark and sailed for Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and left. Well, fortunately, it seems that that argument was later resolved, because in 2 Timothy, Paul's final letter, he says, bring Mark with you because he's helpful to me. So Mark was somebody who was well known in the early church, had a close relationship with its leaders. And in the gospel itself, I said it was anonymous, but there is one tantalizing clue in the gospel of Mark itself. So if you just go back to Mark chapter 14, page 1021, Mark 14, verse 51. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't find it, but I was in Luke. So I hope you haven't made that same mistake. I'm really confusing you now. Mark 14, verse 51. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. A young man who is following Jesus at the end. Maybe that is not in the other two Gospels. Maybe that was Mark as a teenager at the end of Jesus' ministry. Now, we can't be sure, but we do have a statement from a bishop called Papias in Turkey in 130 AD, who said he'd been told by an earlier Christian elder that Mark was Peter's interpreter, and that Mark wrote down accurately the things that Peter said about Jesus, and he arranged them in order in his gospel. In other words, Peter had lots of things he used to teach, and Mark put them together in an orderly account. We can't be sure about whether that's true, though it's quite early evidence. And we also find quite a lot of evidence in the gospel itself that makes it plausible. We know that Peter was in Rome at the end of his life and died there. And Mark very often seems to be explaining things for Roman Gentile readers. If you look at chapter 7, I told you I was going to make you work hard with the Bible. So please look at chapter 7 of Mark, verse 3. You'll see that Mark explains Jewish customs for Gentile readers. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the teaching of the elders. Now, any Jew would have known that, but Mark explains it. He says in chapter 10 that the two coins that the woman put into the temple were worth a quadrantes, which is a Roman coin. And then just look on to chapter 15, verse 16. I found a new way of keeping all awake during my sermons, making it look up all these verses. Just at the bottom of page 1022, verse 16 of chapter 15, the soldiers led Jesus away into the palace. That is the praetorium. That's a Roman term that Mark uses to explain to his readers what's happening. So Mark seems to be writing for Roman readers, but he also includes a lot of Aramaic words directly from the language that Jesus spoke. When Jesus heals Jairus' daughter in chapter 5, he's quoted as saying, "Talitha cum," Aramaic for "little girl, get up." Or again, back in chapter 7, flip back there quickly, verse 34. Verse 34, chapter 7. Jesus looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, I can't pronounce that word, "Ephphatha," or something, which means "be open," an Aramaic word here in Mark. So, you know, there's quite a lot of evidence for the idea that this was an original Aramaic account being explained to Roman readers. There are also, as we saw when we looked at the earlier bit, a lot of little eyewitness details. And I want to show you a couple of examples. Go back a page to the feeding of the 5,000 in chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 39. Then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. Now, that may not seem a big deal to you, but of course in Palestine the grass isn't green normally. It's brown, like it is here. Except in the spring when it rains, and then the grass turns green. And someone remembered that eyewitness detail, not in the other synoptic gospels. Or look at the calming of the storm in chapter 4, page 1006. And I'll just quote you a couple of examples. Verse 36, leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boats. There were also other boats with him. Now, that doesn't add anything to the story. It's just a little eyewitness detail. Verse 38, Jesus was in the stern sleeping on a cushion. Now, those details aren't necessary for the story, and we may not think they're particularly strange. We take them for granted because in the 18th century, people invented a new technique of modern novelistic fiction. They realized that if you added in little unnecessary details when you're telling a story, it makes it sound real. Because that is what real eyewitnesses do when they describe something that they've seen. That was invented in the 18th century, but nobody did it in the first century. And yet those little details are in all four of the Gospels. So we either have to believe that all four Gospel writers simultaneously invented this technique, and then it was forgotten for 1800 years. Not very plausible. All we have to say, these gospel accounts are based on eyewitness testimony. And if you're still on in chapter 4, there's something else interesting here. Look at what the disciples say to Jesus in verse 38. The disciples woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" Do you hear that? Don't you care if we drown? That's quite a rude thing to say to Jesus, isn't it? Matthew and Luke just soften it a bit and they say, "Teacher, we're going to drown." But Mark gives it as they really said it. Don't you care? He's very explicit about the fear and lack of faith of the disciples. And he gives us a very vivid picture of their bewilderment and spiritual blindness. And we often get Jesus in Mark saying things like, "Do you still not understand? Are you so dull?" And at the center of it is Peter. And Jesus says to Peter, as we heard in the second reading, "Get behind me, Satan," when Peter says Jesus shouldn't suffer. Now, of course, Peter was the leader of the tiny church in Rome. Could such an uncomplimentary picture of Peter have been allowed to come into the gospel unless it came from Peter himself? You know, would someone have put that kind of picture of these idiotic disciples in unless it came from the disciples themselves? Remember that Peter knew that the gospel was about grace. Peter knew he'd failed Jesus catastrophically at the key moment, and yet Jesus had forgiven him. And so Mark gives us a very powerful picture of that as we see how often the disciples didn't get it. And for me, that's another very powerful reason for believing that the Gospels are reliable. There's so much in them that you'd never put in if you were making it up. You wouldn't have the leaders of the early church being portrayed as such idiots and full of doubts. You know, who would write that? And you also wouldn't have women as the only witnesses of the resurrection, the key event, which they are in Mark. Remember, they were not allowed to give valid testimony in court. So you'd never make women the only witnesses unless that's what happened. So maybe you're here this morning and you're not a Christian. You're just beginning to wonder whether there might be something in this stuff about Jesus. And I want to say to you, you're in the right place. Please keep coming. This is a safe place to explore and not to be sure and to ask questions. And if you want to find God, don't stare up into the sky looking for a sign, because the sign is here. Jesus is the sign. God has come to us. And so then the question is, well, how do I check that out? How do I find out about Jesus? And the answer is that God has given us this reliable eyewitness account of who Jesus was and what he did. And they recorded what he said. And so we don't have to speculate about it, because what we can check it out, we can ask questions, we can examine it firsthand, the accounts of Jesus and who he was. And when you read the Gospels, I think you will find they have the ring of truth. So the last question really is, what is the key message of Mark's Gospel? What's the distinctive thing about it? As I said, Mark is full of action. He doesn't waste time with birth narratives or genealogies. He just gives us the events of Jesus' life. And if you just go back to the beginning and look through, just flip through the first couple of three or four pages, and you'll see a whole series of different events, healings and arguments and miracles. And Mark's favorite word is the word euthus, which means immediately, and he uses it 42 times in his gospel. It's there in chapter 1, verse 29, as soon as they left the synagogue. He's always moving on to the next thing. And Mark often talks about Jesus' teaching, but he doesn't actually give us much of Jesus' teaching. Instead, he focuses on the action. And we see also the opposition that Jesus' deeds and his words provoked. Just look at chapter 3. The first little section there, the man with a shriveled arm who's Jesus heals on the Sabbath. And look at verse 6 of chapter 3. This is the third page of the gospel. And already it says the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. So within two or three pages, people are plotting to kill Jesus. That's the kind of hostility that his miracles and his claims provoke. And yet there's also amazement and wonder as people see what Jesus has done. And in the middle of it all are the disciples. They're bumbling along, they're bewildered, but they're the key people, because the whole of the first half of the gospel leads up to Peter's suddenly seeing who Jesus is at the end of chapter 8, and that was our second reading. So just go on to Peter's confession of Christ on page 1012. This is the kind of culmination of the whole of the first half of Mark. Chapter 8, verse 27. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" Various answers. "But what about you? Who do you say I am?" And Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Messiah, the King." And that is kind of the climax of all of the first half. That's the question that the first half has been making us ask. And here is the answer. Jesus is God's Messiah, God to the rescue. That's the first half. And then the second half, the focus shifts. And the second half is answering a different question, which is, what kind of Messiah is he? Why has he come? And just look on to verse 31. Jesus then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Again, very honest about Peter. And Jesus, in response to that, looks at his disciples. He rebukes Peter. He says, "Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." And then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Down to verse 38. "If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him. Take up your cross, follow me." That's what it means to be a disciple. And the climax to the second half comes in chapter 15. On the cross. Just go on to that if you will. First half led up to Peter recognizing that Jesus is the Christ. The second half leads up to someone else recognizing who he is. And interestingly, the one who does it, the key person in the second half, is a Roman, a centurion, a soldier. Verse 37, "With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, 'Surely this man was the Son of God.'" That's when he sees who Jesus is. As Jesus dies, suffering for the world on the cross, he understands that this is the Son of God. So the second half is showing us that he's a suffering Messiah who came to give his life for us. And if we want to follow him, we too need to take up our cross. So Mark is a kind of discipleship manual for the first Christians. Think how appropriate that was for those early Christians in Rome, when the church was just beginning to face serious persecution from the Roman Empire. In 64 AD, there was a great fire in Rome. The Emperor Nero blamed the Christians for starting it, and many Christians were martyred, including Peter, traditionally where St. Peter's Church now is. And when they read Mark, they would have said, "Don't be surprised when you suffer at the hands of the authorities and you're attacked and persecuted. Don't be ashamed about that. Because this is what happened to Jesus, and this is what he told you again and again that was going to be your fate if you followed him. Take up your cross and follow me." That was a literal cross for those early Roman Christians. And maybe that even explains the rather strange ending to Mark. Just turn finally to chapter 16, just over the page. And you'll see the last bit, verses 9 to 20, are separated out. And it says, "Most reliable early manuscripts and other ancient witnesses don't have them. They're generally thought not to be part of Mark's gospel." And they were probably composed later from bits of Matthew and Luke. And I guess the reason they were added was that people felt verse 8 was an inadequate ending. Look at verse 8. "Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. That's a strange ending, isn't it? Now, it's possible we lost the original ending, but that seems quite unlikely to me because people were very careful about preserving the gospel, and none of the early, all the early manuscripts end here. So maybe Mark intended to end at verse 8. You know, the first witnesses, those women, were trembling and afraid, and yet we know that they went out and told others because the faith spread. And that's what you need to do when you're trembling and afraid, early, nervous Roman Christians, as the weight of the Roman Empire begins to bear down on you. This is the good news. It's the gospel of Jesus Christ. And once you've got it, you've got to share it. So don't be afraid to do so. If Mark was the young man who fled in fear, he later came back. And he certainly deliberately deserted Paul and Barnabas, and yet here he is continuing to spread the good news, telling people about what has happened. He's overcome his fear, and so should you. So I want to say to us today in Southeast London, we may be trembling and afraid to tell others about our faith, but read Mark, because it is reliable evidence. God has given it to us to encourage us to believe and to pass on the good news. Now, I've been longer than I expected to be. I'm sorry about that. So I think we probably won't have questions, but do ask me later. And next week, John Clark will be looking at Matthew.